Well, good evening. I hope your day and evening has not been as hectic as mine, because admittedly I'm trying to focus. Last week, we were looking at this city in the eastern delta of Egypt in what was once known as the land of Goshen. The Egyptians knew it as Avaris, and it, as well as these other Semitic sites marked by white dots, were obviously occupied by Semites, that is people from the Syria, Palestine, Canaan area. A number of things tell us that, among them, the graves. Notice how this individual is buried on the left side, knees tucked up, usually facing east, in a mud brick tomb, just exactly as we learned from Scripture, that the Israelites were making blocks out of mud brick. This is the typical way a Semite culture would bury their dead. This is not how Egyptians bury their dead. The grave goods are Semitic. These are Semitic weapons with ivory handles. And there are a number of other features that tell Egyptologists that the people living in this city of Avaris were Semites. As Professor Hoffmeyer says, we know that there was a large Semitic-speaking population which probably came from Syria, Canaan. We have tombs that are clearly those of foreigners. We can tell this by the pottery, by the kind of weapons. The type of tombs, the types of architecture are not Egyptian. The material culture of these people fits with the southern Levant, the southern part of Canaan. And as we talked about last week, this was a big city. It started out small, but it got very big very fast. This man, Professor Manfred Bietak, is the Austrian Egyptologist, archaeologist who has been excavating this city for over 30 years. And we noted last week what he said about this city. We uncovered the remains of a huge town of 250 hectares, 618 acres, square mile, with a population of approximately 25,000 to 30,000 individuals. These were people who have originated from Canaan, Syria, Palestine. Originally, they may have come here as subjects of the Egyptian crown or with the blessing of the Egyptian crown. Obviously, this town enjoyed something like a special status, like a free zone, something like that. And we saw that last week that fits perfectly with the biblical narrative. Why would the children of Israel's home in Egypt have qualified as a quote-unquote free zone? Well, Joseph would have contributed to it, but what else do we know about the children of Israel that would have made the Egyptians, that they were doing something different than Egyptians did? They were shepherds. And the Egyptians regarded that as defiled to even have to eat with them. So yes, they lived over here in this, the best land, the land of Goshen, granted to them by the vizier, the Pharaoh, through the vizier, Joseph. And they did have a special status. This man also acknowledges that these were shepherds. And notice, by the way, I didn't point this out last week. He says, we find again and again in this area pits with goats and sheep. And we know what kinds of sheep these were. These were sheep from Syria. These were not sheep from another part of the world. Everything about this city tells us that these were Semitic people, fitting exactly with the biblical narrative. Now, Manfred Bietak says all these things which line up perfectly with the Bible says. Here's that reconstruction we looked at last week. Here's another one, what an aerial view of the city might have looked like. You see the mud brick homes there being the Semitic sector, the white being the royal sector. Here's another view. I found this picture, didn't have it last week. Here it is from another angle. These little sections right here, this is your geology lesson. These are called turtlebacks. The Pelusiac branch of the Nile divided up a number of these. Avaris set on more than one. So this Semitic city we're talking about set on various of these turtlebacks. So it was a big area. And here's that close-up view where the palace is right next to the Semitic city, which fit with the fact that Jochebed could lay Moses in the water and know that the princess would pick him up, how Moses and Aaron are able to get to the palace quickly and go right back to the people, and in less than 24 hours have them getting out of Egypt. They had to be close. But the question was raised to me this past Sunday by someone who's been attending here. And I've heard that when politicians get letters from constituents, at least this used to be the case, I don't know how many letters they get these days, but when they get a letter from a constituent, they consider that that letter represents 20 to 25 others who didn't write. And when I get a question like the one I got on Sunday, I'm guessing there are probably other people who might ask the same question, but who just didn't. And that question was this. John, I'm looking at all this archaeology. It fits the Bible's testimony point by point by point. But you've got the guy who's doing the very dig and other Egyptologists who say, no, this is not Israel. And you have mentioned this thing called the conventional Egyptian chronology and how it doesn't really fit with what the Bible reveals and with what other archaeologists are now espousing. What's going on here? Why is this when the evidence is so compelling that people can look at it and say, no, that's not the children of Israel. That's not what's going on here. So I'm going to risk going into this just a little bit and ask that you bear with me. I know we're here to see cool pictures of archaeological artifacts, but this is relevant. So I hope you'll bear with me here because it's a very good question and it does deserve an answer. When historians are trying to establish a chronology, that is a timeline of an ancient culture, they don't have a nice group of documents that say, okay, in BC 943 this happened, and then in 683 BC this happened. So they have to find a way to nail down some dates if they can, and then from those what are called absolute dates, they make a bunch of relative dates. That is, what, for example, we know that Nebuchadnezzar took the city of Jerusalem in 587 BC. We know that. That's been nailed down. Well, let's say we know that we come across an ancient document that says 5 years after Nebuchadnezzar took Jerusalem. Well, we can date that to 582 BC, not because we have a document that says so, but because we can relate it back to that absolute date we've been able to nail down. So that's how chronologies are created. This book right here is called The Mysterious Numbers of the Hebrew Kings. If you like details and you like history, this might be the book for you. I own one. It looks nice on the shelf. I've not yet read very much of it, admittedly. Brother Dennis Stanley used this book to a large degree, I believe, in putting together his biblical chronology class. In 1943, Edwin Thiel, he was a German-American evangelical scholar, he dug in to the numbers of in Kings and Chronicles that said, you know, this king reigned this long, this king reigned this long. Has anyone ever sat down and added those up together? If you take all the kings of Judah and you add up their reigns, you take the kings of Israel and add up their reigns, you'd say, okay, well, they're all going to line up. Well, if you just add up the numbers at face value, they don't line up. And Edwin Thiel believed that this book was from God, as we do. He believed it was giving us trustworthy information, so what he sought to do was figure out what the Bible meant when it said some of those things. And what he discovered was, for example, this is an example of the sort of thing he posits in the book. How long did David and Solomon reign? 40 years. So if you went from the first day of Saul's reign to the last day of Solomon's reign, that'll give you 120 years, right? Would it? There certainly was, right? David was still alive and still king even when Solomon was coronated. That's called a co-regency where there will be overlap. The Bible doesn't tell us how much overlap there was that I'm aware of. But Thiel worked off of this principle and found that by working with this principle and comparing what the Bible said with other countries, particularly Assyria, and he brought in a solar eclipse and a whole bunch of stuff, he nailed down this chronology in this book, where, in other words, he nailed down a date for the break of the southern and northern kingdoms of 930 BC. Now, he's a Bible believer, but the work he did was so good and matched up so well with archaeological and astronomical data that was available at the time and with data that has been discovered since, that Thiel's book here is the definitive study, and even today is the accepted chronology among scholars for Israel and Judah from the time of Omri and Ahab to the fall of Jerusalem. Now, why am I bringing all that up? Because Thiel's confirmed work has been combined with less reliable information and has helped create the conventional Egyptian chronology that exists today. Bear with me for a moment. Well, I tell a little bit more history. 1822, a man by the name of, I'll just put his last name up here. He was a Frenchman, Champollion, Jean-Francois Champollion. He was a linguistic prodigy, and he was obsessed with trying to decipher the hieroglyphs. The Rosetta Stone had been discovered. Here's all these Egyptian monuments and temples, all this history locked up on those walls, and no one could read it. Well, with the Rosetta Stone discovered, he became obsessed with deciphering it, and he figured it out. 1822, he puts himself on the historic map as the man who figured it out. 6 years later, he goes down to Egypt to make use of what he's learned. It's the only time he went down to Egypt. He almost kills himself, literally, making copies of these things on the wall, knowing he might never get back, studying. He literally almost killed himself. He was a monomaniac with a mission, as people like that often are. Among the vast ruins of a temple in Karnak, he found a cartouche. When you're looking, reading, when you're reading hieroglyphs, as you always do at home, and you come across one of these, and I'll just, you know, put a bunch of symbols here. The Egyptians would, they do it, they would write as the ox plows, so you would read it this way. But every once in a while, they would take a group of symbols and they would put a little oval-like thing around them. That's called a cartouche, and what they were telling you is, that's a name. That's a name. It's not just a place or a thought, it's a name. So he'd figured all this out, largely, and he comes across this cartouche and he reads the name, I'm going to give it away, of a king named Shoshank the First. Shoshank was the one who had built the temple, and Shoshank, on another relief, where all these carvings into the wall, he found that Shoshank had engaged in a military campaign into Canaan. Okay, so we got a pharaoh named Shoshank who engages in a military campaign into Canaan. And by the way, one of Champollion's goals when he went down to Egypt was he wanted to see if he could find a reference to a biblical place or person in the hieroglyphs. Well, not only has Shoshank gone into Canaan, but as Champollion is reading what are called name rings, all the places that Shoshank claimed to have conquered or visited, he comes across one that he translates Yehuda Ha Malkuth, which means Judah the Kingdom. So reason with Champollion for a moment. We have a man named Shoshank, an Egyptian pharaoh, who went into the kingdom of Judah. You don't have a kingdom of Judah until this date, right? After they break up. You don't have a kingdom of Judah under David. You have a kingdom of Judah under Rehoboam on. And he knew his Bible. And the very first pharaoh the Bible mentions is a man named Shishak. And Shishak took a campaign into Judah in the fifth year of Rehoboam, conquered Jerusalem, took a bunch of the goods. The Bible says he took everything, took those golden shields of Solomon and so forth. And Shoshank and Shishak sound quite a bit alike. So Champollion says we got the same man. Shoshank in Egyptian, Shishak in Hebrew. He went into Judah and he conquered in Judah. I have the same man here. And I won't bore you with a whole bunch of the other details, but the man whose dates serve as Egyptologists' chronological dates, his work in the 1970s, he called this connection the essential synchronism. That is the essential connection between historical cultures, which now allows us to have an absolute date for Egyptian chronology to work from. And that date is 925, and I won't bore you with, or 945 BC. I won't bore you how he got there. Okay. I'm ready for this part to be over, John. I won't be here too much longer. There are problems with this. Number one, Champollion never lived to see it, but in 1888, a Frenchman showed the world, those who cared, that kingdom, that Judah the kingdom, Champollion had read it wrong. He had his hieroglyphs down, but they weren't down perfect, and he had misread it. It actually said a place called Yad HaMelech, which literally means hand of the king, and it's a city way up north of Judah. That doesn't fit. Champollion's mistake is universally acknowledged by scholars today. Everyone's in agreement. Yes, he was wrong on that point. Well, but why do they say that Shoshank and Shishak are the same? Well, their names do sound the same. And they both went into Judah, right? Well, that's the other problem. Shishak went into Judah, according to 2 Chronicles chapters 11 and 12. He went into Judah, and he conquered the fortified cities of Judah, and he took the city of Jerusalem. If you go through the 150 to 180 names of all those locations that Shoshank says he conquered, you only read one of those fortified cities of Judah, and he hits it on his way up north. And then he passes along the western edge of Judah down south. He invades Israel. He invades south of Judah. But he never takes the city of Jerusalem. And he doesn't conquer Judah. In other words, now what do we have? We have no connection. We just have two guys whose names sound similar. So you'd think the world of Egyptology would say, oh, we need to rethink this. But after you've had decades or longer to build an entire structure on a foundation piece like this, how quickly do you think people are going to want to change? How quickly do we want to change? All the people you talk to about religion, when you show them that what they believe is not in the Bible, they change right just like that, right? We don't like change. And what if your career has been built? You've written textbooks, you've written articles, you've been teaching your students for all these years. Your entire career is built on this mistake. People being what they are, they don't want to let it go. But there are some who are. And I've got some quotes here, but I won't go into it. But we may be seeing the early phases of a fundamental change. Egyptologists are aware of these things, and new information like we've been looking at. And change does seem to be beginning to happen in some sectors. But until such a change occurs, they are working with a chronology that has the dates in the wrong places because their absolute date was bogus. And so they take the Bible's events and they impose it on a chronology that's off. And so they look for evidence of the children of Israel in the wrong time period. And guess what? They don't find it. And so hence the Bible's not right. They go to a city of Jericho, which Lord willing we'll look at next week. They find a city that's been destroyed exactly like the Bible says, but it's in the wrong time period. In fact, when Joshua came to Jericho, there was no city there. Because they're making false assumptions. And one of those false assumptions we had just started to look at last week, and that is the location of that city of Avaris. The Bible says that Joseph settled his father and his brothers in the land of Goshen, right? But in Genesis 47:11, it also said he settled them where? In the land of Ramses. So the Bible speaks of the land of Goshen and the land of Ramses as if they're the same place. Because apparently they are. At least they cover some of the same area. It says in Exodus chapter 1, verse 11, that the children of Israel built for Pharaoh supply cities, Pithom and Ramses. So the Egyptologists say, okay, Ramses was built in the reign of Ramses II, and based on our chronology, he didn't reign till the 1200s B.C., so that's when the children of Israel, if they were ever in Egypt at all, that's when they were in Egypt. Well, if you follow that chronology, you'll find that when they came to Jericho, there was no city. You'll find that that doesn't match up with the Bible at all. But what if that name Ramses is that word called an anachronism? Could somebody remind us again what an anachronism is? Anachronism, what is it? Exactly. And I cited examples of that last week, and so I won't take time to do that now. But what if Ramses was the name that this location was known by at a later date, and the biblical writers are inserting that, just like we might say the Dutch established New York, and so on and so forth. Because sure enough, if you go to the city of Ramses, and you dig down, guess what you find? the city of Avaris. It sits right under the southern sector of Ramses. And in fact, during the Ramesside era, they mention that it and Avaris occupy the same space. So this was known in the ancient world. Avaris and Ramses are in the same location, same place, different names at different times. I would suggest that may well be what we're looking at in the Bible, that someone came along later, inspired by God, and inserted a few things into the text of the law. And you say, well, John, that bothers me a little bit. Moses wrote Genesis through Deuteronomy, and you're telling me that the city was known as Avaris in the days of Moses. That bothers me. Understandable question. But have you ever noticed? Genesis 36:31. Now these were the kings who reigned in the land of Edom before any king reigned over the children of Israel. Did Moses ever see a king reign over Israel? No, and yet somebody included in Genesis 36:31 that kings reigned in Israel. How likely, I'm not going to say it's impossible, but how likely is it that Moses recorded his own death and his own burial? It would seem unlikely. In other words, Moses did write those five books of law. Jesus confirmed this. But somewhere along the line, and we have a lot of biblical indicators of this, these books were gone back through. Additions were made. For clarification, apparently the Lord thought this was best to give us the book we have now. So this being called Ramses, even though it wasn't known as Ramses at the time the children of Israel were there, is not a problem. And it answers the question. Okay. New material. We saw last week that in Avaris, we've got this Semitic population, appears to be the children of Israel, and I didn't mention perhaps that it's wealthy. All the indications are there's wealth, and you would expect that. Privileged status, best of the land, wealthy. Exodus chapter 1, verse 8 says, "Now there arose a new king in Egypt who did not know Joseph." The 26th ruler of the 13th dynasty was a man named Sobekhotep III. He was a usurper to the throne. He was connected with the Theban military down there in southern Egypt, in Thebes. And with no obvious connection to the royal family of Amenemhat III, the man I am proposing was the Pharaoh of Joseph, he would have seen himself as owing no loyalty to the now deceased Joseph. He or one of his immediate successors, it seems, may well have been the Pharaoh who did not know Joseph. While this man is in power, what's going on in Avaris? Well, archaeology reveals that things have begun to deteriorate. The bones in Avaris that are buried now begin to show signs of malnutrition. Does anyone know what a Harris line is? Someone in the medical profession? I thought Jeremy might know, standing around the corners. Harris lines. These are observable phenomena in the bones of people who have slowed or stopped growing. It's a sign that they're not getting the nutrition that they need. And we begin to see this in Avaris. People who were wealthy now aren't even getting enough to eat. People are dying prematurely between the ages of 32 and 34. And guess what else is happening? There are far more burials of infants than is normal for an ancient civic society. In an ancient society like this, normally, if you go through the cemetery, about 25% of the graves are infants. There was a pretty high mortality rate among babies. A lot of babies get saved. I was one of them that got saved. I was 6 weeks premature. Had it not been for technology and God working through that, I would have been dead. 25% normally are found to be in dead or be buried in a cemetery. 25% of infants. 25% of the burials are infants. But in Manfred B. Tack's dig reports, his team writes of an extremely high mortality rate of newborns. Among the children's graves of those 10 and younger, get this, 50% almost had died in the first 3 months of life. That sounds familiar. What about the adults? Of those who made it to adulthood, when they looked at the graves, there had been a notable reduction in which gender? The male. Instead of a 50-50 break, now you have a 60-40. There were three women for every two men. And the disparity is also reflected in the slave records of the time. The slaves are predominantly female. This fits. Exodus 1, 15 and 16. Then the king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives, of whom the name of one was Shiphrah and the name of the other Puah, and said, "When you do the duties of a midwife for the Hebrew women and see them on the birth stools, if it is a son, then you shall kill him. But if it is daughter, then you shall live." Now, anybody remember the names? I just read them. Anybody remember the names of the midwives? What were their names? I said Puah, and the other one was Shiphrah. Now, they were told to murder the Hebrew boys. Did they? No. But let's go to Exodus chapter 1. And I bring this up because you might be thinking, well, I see what's going on here in the graves, John, but they didn't kill the babies. The Hebrew boys didn't get killed. Would someone read Exodus chapter 1, verse 22, please? So not only were the midwives commanded to kill the children, but who else? Everybody. So the Egyptians had a command across the country. Kill the Hebrew boys soon after they're born, or when they're born. And notice Jochebed in chapter 2, Moses' mother. Chapter 2, verse 2. So the woman conceived and bore a son, and when she saw that he was a beautiful child, she hid him how long?
3 months.
But when she could no longer hide him, I guess they get a little loud by that age, she took an ark of bulrushes, and you know the rest of the story. What had been observed among the burials? Among those 3 months and younger, the mortality, 50% of the graves were children that age. Well, what about the children of Israel being slaves? Is there any evidence for that? Well, we have a papyrus known as the Brooklyn Papyrus. That's where it's housed. It's up in Brooklyn right now. It's a Middle Kingdom Egyptian papyrus. It's from an Upper Egypt farming estate. So a farming estate had a lot of slaves, and we have found the list documenting those slaves. There are 95 slaves on the list. 70% of the slaves have Semitic names. 70% of the slaves on this estate had Semitic names. And look at some of the names. Shiphrah, Asher, Menahem, that one of the kings of Israel, Issachar. As you can see, the papyrus isn't in very good shape. But now, is that the Shiphrah? Probably not. But there are these names. The children of Israel were in Egypt. They were slaves. The majority of them were female because the boys had been getting killed. And the archaeological record bears this out. But the Bible tells us that God delivered his people from this situation. Before I proceed, are there any comments or questions? Does the archaeological record confirm the Bible's claims on the children of Israel exiting Egypt? And this is kind of the big one, isn't it? Because there were 10 plagues. The kingdom had been ruined, the Bible says. Moses said 40 years later, as they're getting ready to go into the promised land, Egypt's army is destroyed to this day. They've still not recovered. The archaeology ought to show some evidence of this. I guess each week there's been a part of the presentation that was my favorite. This is this week's. We have an Egyptian papyrus that goes by this name commonly. It is housed in the Netherlands in the Leiden Museum. It is the only copy of the document we have. It's been in the possession of the museum since 1828, but no one realized the significance of its contents until it was published. A full translation was published in 1909 by a British Egyptologist named Alan Gardner. You can get on Google if you're interested. because I wanted to. I kept reading these books that was quoting from it, and I was like, I want to read this thing. Where do I find it? And I looked and looked and finally found it. And there are multiple translations out there. There was one done recently in 2009, an Oxford edition. But anyway, I found a copy of the 1909. It's actually been photocopied, and you can page through it on Google. So it's out there if you're interested. The technical name is Papyrus Leyden. Leyden's where it is, 344. It's more popularly known by this name up here, as I said. And it's written in hieratic. Somebody told me today that when people start talking about Greek, this person just waits until they get done. I'm sure I know some of you out there feel this way. For those of you who have an interest, there are two words in the New Testament for temple. The one is Naas, and the other one is Hieron. Hieron, technically, emphasis on the last syllable. I really can't remember which is which at the moment, but one of these refers to the actual sanctuary and the other to the temple precincts. And that's good to know, because remember when Jesus, when Judas throws the money into the temple, I think this is the sanctuary. He actually threw it into the sanctuary. He went up to the door and he threw the money literally inside the temple. When Jesus was taken to the pinnacle of the temple, it's the temple precincts. In other words, the high point there, he wasn't actually on the building itself, probably. All that said, this word for temple is why we have hieroglyphic. It's the temple writing, or the holy writing. And hieratic is the language that's written in right there. It's kind of a stylized version of hieroglyphs. Bear with me while I give you a little more information. The grammar and literary figures used in this document, as well as the terms and people, occur historically only after the 12th dynasty. That is, only after the days of Amenemhat III, the guy who was probably Pharaoh during the days of Egypt. So it fits the time. It comes much later. Sobekhotep, the man I mentioned earlier, was in the 13th dynasty. It is generally thought to have been penned by this fellow right here, because his name's in the document. Ippur. Ippur is his name. We don't have everything in the document. We're missing the first part and the last part. But at one point in the document it says, these are the words that Ippur answered to the king. So whoever Ippur was, he was in a position to address the king. He was in a position of power, influence, status. And Ippur, here's where it starts to get good. Ippur claims to have been an eyewitness of a disaster that struck Egypt. And he is admonishing the current king. He confronts the reigning Pharaoh and admonishes him for his failure to rectify the situation that this catastrophe had created. And according to one man's reading of it, Ippur laments the fact that one of the earlier pharaohs had not wiped out those Asiatics who came out of Egypt. In poetic form, it's a poem, just like when you're reading Psalms, you can read a story, but it's in poetic form. This papyrus is in poetic form. And let's compare it to the Bible. Exodus chapter 4, verse 9, God says to Moses, "You shall take water from the river and pour it on the dry land. The water which you take from the river will become blood on the dry land." We all know that story, right? "Behold," poetic, remember, "Egypt is fallen to the pouring water, and he who poured water on the ground seizes the mighty in misery." Who is this who pours water on the ground? Exodus chapter 7, verses 20 and 21. "All the waters that were in the river turned to blood. The fish that were in the river died. The river stank, and the Egyptians could not drink the water of the river." Ippur writes, "The river is blood. If you drink of it, you lose your humanity and thirst for water." Exodus 9. "And the Lord rained hail on the land of Egypt. The flax and the barley were struck. There remained nothing green on the trees or on the plants of the field." Now, if that happened, what would be going on in the kingdom? Well, it's part of the plagues, but A day-to-day life, how would that affect you if you were an Egyptian? You'd be hungry, right? Gone is the barley of abundance. Food supplies are running short. The nobles hunger and suffer. Those who had shelter are in the dark of the storm. One translation of Ippur even says, the entire delta cannot be seen, which is interesting. Exodus chapter 10, verse 7. How long shall this man be a snare to us? Pharaoh's servants said to him, let the men go, that they may serve the Lord their God. Do you not yet know that Egypt is destroyed? Ippur says, what shall we do about it? Twice he says, all is ruin. Exodus 12, 29 through 30. At midnight, the Lord struck all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh who sat on his throne to the firstborn of the captive who was in the dungeon. There was not a house where there was not one dead. Ippur writes, behold, plague sweeps the land. Blood is everywhere, with no shortage of the dead. He who buries his brother in the ground is everywhere. Exodus 12, 30. So Pharaoh rose in the night, he and all his servants and all the Egyptians, and there was a great cry in Egypt. Ippur writes, wailing is throughout the land, mingled with lamentations. Moses tells us, now this is really interesting to me. Now the children of Israel had done according to the word of Moses, and they had asked from the Egyptians articles of silver, articles of gold, and clothing. And the Lord had given the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians so that they granted them what they requested. Thus they plundered the Egyptians. People are stripped of clothes. The slave takes what he finds. Behold, gold, lapis lazuli, silver, and turquoise, carnelian, amethysts, emeralds, and all precious stones are strung on the necks of who? Female slaves. But there's one other. Notice I have some of them underlined. Let's go over to Exodus 28 for a moment. Exodus 28. Here was instructions for making the breastplate for the high priest. We're going to start in verse 17. Exodus 28:17. And you shall put settings of stones in it, four rows of stones. The first row shall be a sardius, a topaz, and an emerald. This shall be the first row. The second row shall be a turquoise, a sapphire, and a diamond. The third row, a jacinth, an agate, and an amethyst. And the fourth row, a beryl, an onyx, and a jasper. They shall be set in gold settings. You ever wondered? I never thought about this. But where do a bunch of slaves get all these valuable stones? From the Egyptians that they plundered? At least that's certainly the way it looks. When asked, when the curator, I think he may have been the curator, of the Leiden Museum, was asked about the Ippur Papyrus. Because he accepts the current chronology, and his response, he dismisses it, and he also says, Ippur did not see these things. He's pretending to be an eyewitness to these things. It's interesting. You know, we are most susceptible to believing what we want to believe. And if we don't want to believe something, we find a way. He didn't see these things. He claims to see them, but he's pretending. It's not true. Any comments or questions? We've got just a few more minutes. Okay. Well, I'm sorry to say I lost a slide. Let me read to you some evidence, further evidence we have of the plagues. Without the slides, I'd better not go through all these names. There's a man by the name of Artapanus. I'll mention his name. He was a 2nd century BC Jew. Remember the Ptolemies and the Seleucids? Remember those from when we get our study of Daniel? Cleopatra was the last ruler of the Ptolemies down in Egypt. In the 2nd century BC, the Ptolemies were still quite powerful, and Artapanus was in their employ. He was a historian, and he was asked to write, he was commissioned to write a history of the Jewish people in Egypt. And of course, he was going to write it in Greek, because that was the Greek of the day. Artapanus, this Jew, living over 100 years before Christ, gives us the name of the princess who drew Moses out of the water. He said her name was Princess Maris. I guess I am going to do these names. Princess Maris married a man with this name, Artapanus says. And this is the name of a pharaoh. And that pharaoh is known to us today as Dudemos. Pardon me, I've got that wrong. We'll come back to that. It's actually Sobekhotep IV. Now we have another document that takes us after Sobekhotep IV to another pharaoh later, and that man is named Dudemos. All this is coming from the archaeological and historical finds that we have. Now why do I go through all that? Well, this is interesting. We have a Jew telling us, who is much, much closer to the time than we are, this is the princess's name. She married this man who became Pharaoh. He is known by both of these names. So he tells us that Moses actually grew up to become a very popular prince in Egypt, that he actually became a successful military commander. Josephus confirms this. It's not inspired history, but it's interesting. And later on, this man came to power. And another Jew by the name of Manetho says during Dudemos' reign, quote, "In his reign, for what cause I know not, God smote us," that is the Egyptians. Now, Manetho is an Egyptian, but did you notice something about that quote? He doesn't say the gods smote us. What does he say? God smote us. And he goes on to say, "And unexpectedly from the regions of the east, invaders of obscure race marched in confidence of victory against our land." Here's the important point. "By main force, they easily seized our land without striking a blow." So he says, God smote us in Dudemos' time, and then this other race of people marched right into our country and took it without ever having to strike a blow. Now, in order to take a country without striking a blow, what has to be true? What's that? There's no army. There's no one to fight back. Which fits with what Moses said, which fits with what the Pharaoh and the army were killed in the sea. And interestingly, and I didn't quote this, Ippur also mentions God in the singular. And he says that a man says, "If I knew where God was, I would sacrifice to him." Very interesting. Pagan polytheistic culture speaking of God. Two last quotes. What is most striking about the excavation at Avaris is the evidence that the work on the palace in the eastern Nile Delta, so they apparently were working on that palace, it was suddenly stopped. Manfred Bietak says that the pots of paint, the plumb lines, and the instruments were suddenly dropped to the floor. The palace was suddenly abandoned. Normally, when a city or a town declines, like you can drive all over the Midwest, you drive into these old towns, and in most cases, what do you see? You see towns where there used to be a lot more people than there are, and they've left, and it's gradually declining. In Avaris, all the people disappear, the city is suddenly abandoned, and then the city falls into ruin. Nobody comes in to reoccupy it. In another city, Kahun, where a bunch of Semitic slaves were living, we read, Petrie, an archaeologist, in his excavations at Kahun, it revealed that the Semitic population had literally abandoned the pyramid workers' town in an instant, leaving daily utensils and pottery lying on the floors of their houses. Egyptologists have struggled to find an explanation for this abrupt departure, but they are, of course, not looking for the exodus of Semites from Egypt at this time because of that chronology, which I bored you with all the details about earlier. But it matters. It matters. Assumptions matter. We can go where men have said we could go, or we can go where the evidence takes us. And where does the evidence take us? Israelites were living in Egypt 1,500 years before Jesus came. They were wealthy, as would be expected. But they were made into slaves. Their boys were killed. But God delivered them through a series of disasters that the Egyptian kingdom took years to recover from. And he will deliver you if you are in Egypt now. That is, if you are in slavery. He who sins is the servant of sin. That's what Jesus says. You're a slave of sin. If sin's got its hold on you tonight, and you are ready to be free, you're ready to submit and be free, then the invitation's for you. Let's stand and sing.